This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Welcome in conversation with Julia Wheeler, a man with adventure in his soul, Nicholas Crane.
Wonderful to see so many people here. Thank you very much for coming and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival and to a talk, a chat, a conversation about geography, which is both of our favourite subjects, so that's great, and I'm sure the favourite subject of many people in the audience. So, Nicholas Crane, on the back of the book, it says, there's a quote from the Daily Mail which says that you've become something of a national treasure. How do you feel about that?
Well, about the Daily Mail or the quote?
Well, a little bit of both.
The Daily Mail also called me a prat a long time ago. That was when I walked in a straight line from one end to the other of England. So you have to take the slight pinch of salt, anything said by the Mail. But no, obviously very, very flattered. But I'm not sure about a national treasure. Britain is a treasure, and I've written most of my life I've been writing about Britain. And it's not difficult to find treasures on this amazing island. So, yeah, it's been productive for me.
But this latest book is wonderful. I mean, it takes a much bigger picture, doesn't it? I mean, the central premise of the book is that geography's moment has come. How so?
Well, I think we could argue that there have been several great ages of geography. You know, the classical era, the 16th century, when modern map-making came to the fore in the Low Countries in particular, people like Mercator. And then now, because if you look at all of the world's major global challenges, look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals, for example, they're all geographical, whether it's migration or poverty, equality, hunger, rising sea levels, climate change, they're all geographical issues. And we need geographical solutions, and therefore we need geographers. We need more young geographers coming through school. So the book, as much as anything, is a celebration of geography.
So lots of those things that you mentioned, you know, climate change in particular, and those sustainable development goals, which are 2030, I think, aren't they, they're aimed at, to individuals seem so big and so difficult that we wonder, OK, but what can we do individually to make a difference?
I often think of some of the bigger journeys I've done, where I've set off to do something that's much bigger than I can imagine accomplishing. For example, walking across Europe from the Atlantic to the Black Sea, that was a distance of about 10,000 kilometres on my own, following the mountains all the way. And when I set off on a spring day in 1992, Istanbul, which is where I was trying to get to, seemed unimaginably far away. But I could imagine getting to the end of that first day, finding a bivouac site, unrolling my sleeping bag, and so on. I could imagine that first day. So it's a question of biting off small chunks at a time, and in operating on two scales. At one scale, we can do a lot ourselves, and clearly in terms of reducing carbon footprint, giving up eating meat, for example, is a very big thing to do. That's a big difference. Reducing our car use and so on, reducing the use of plastics, all these have big environmental impacts if they're multiplied out. At the bigger scale, if you belong or live in a democracy, we have to vote in policymakers who understand geography. It's that simple.
Who are those policymakers? Who has geography up there on their manifesto or in their individual manifesto?
Well, as it happens, we do have a prime minister at the moment in this country with a geography degree. I'm not sure it's doing as much good, there are not enough policymakers with geographical backgrounds. So I don't mean necessarily a geography degree. It's enough. By the time you've come through to GCSE level, you understand the basics behind all the UN Sustainable Development Goals. We're not talking about, you know, academic geography or doing a degree. We're just talking about concentrating through to GCSE. That's enough to give you the wherewithal to make sound policy decisions. At the moment, as we know from this country and America, politicians are enormously distracted by much more parochial issues, and we've got the complete opposite of what we need, which is a global consensus on the future of the planet. Mm.
So one of the things that you say in this book is that actually geography teachers, who, you know, often much maligned, and it's all about colouring in and oxbow lakes.
Drives me nuts, that.
I can imagine. Yeah. Actually hold the future of the world in their hands.
Yeah, they do. I'd like to see all geography teachers put on the pantheon of the social greats. They need to be up there with, you know, our leading academics and our leading politicians, our leading statespeople. You know, geography teachers do hold the future in their hands. It's their enthusiasm, it's their ability to share their knowledge that will produce the next great generation of policymakers. So we absolutely need to support our teaching profession as a whole, because it's not just geography teachers. For example, climate change, to solve climate change issues, to understand climate change, we need chemists and physicists as well. But geography is a subject which brings everything together. It's the all-embracing subject discipline that allows you to spot the connections between the components on the planet that create this dynamic spaceship that we're riding on.
By definition, that is really complicated, and politicians, to me, seem to be, in the big pictures, things are good or bad, they're evil or they're good. It is that dichotomy between the two things. So what can we do to kind of say, actually, it's a bit more complicated than that, and you need to get your heads around it, Mr. Trump and others?
Well, the first thing, and you've used the word complicated, the first thing is to acknowledge that it is complicated and that there aren't any simple solutions, and it's not a question of right or wrong or yes or no. For example, if you look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals, you know, there's an inbuilt contradiction within one of them, which is seeking solutions through developing market economies. Well, you know, one of the reasons the planet's got the difficulties it has at the moment is through unrestrained market economics. You can't have unlimited growth when you have finite resources. It just doesn't work. So even within the Sustainable Development Goals, there's a bit of tweaking to be done. So we do need to acknowledge that it's very complicated, but we can also acknowledge that we can do something about it by addressing the issues that we do understand. We do understand now the connection between fossil fuel emissions and global warming. It's incredibly straightforward. That bit isn't complicated. We simply need to stop pumping up as much CO2 and methane into the atmosphere as we are at the moment. Mm.
And I know that you've cycled here this morning with that. So, I mean, how much do you embody what you preach? Preach is too strong a word, but talk about. I mean, are you vegan?
I'm not vegan, no. I have more or less given up meat, but I'm not vegan. I'm kind of heading that way. I'm heading that way.
How many other people are sort of heading that way towards vegan? One. Vegetarians? Yeah, okay, more. Okay, did anybody do veganuary? Not so much, no. Okay. So let's talk then about climate change, because you say that, slightly counterintuitively, we need to study the Ice Age in order to understand global warming. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that seeming contradiction.
We were talking just before we came onto stage about a great hero of mine, Jamie Woodward, who's a professor at Manchester University. And Jamie has written a wonderful little book called The Ice Age for the Oxford University Press Brief Introduction series. And if you want to know about the Ice Age, read Jamie's book. It's short enough to read on a train journey. And he tells it as it is. He's a brilliant professor, but also he's a great communicator. So for me, it was just, you know, the Ice Age in a nutshell. But our circumstances in Britain, for example, are that only 12,000 years ago, there was nobody on this peninsula that we now call Britain at all. It was buried under ice. There were reindeer walking past Olympia here, it was far too cold for any human beings. But then, about 11,600 years ago, there was an episode of extreme global warming, completely natural, to do with Milankovitch cycles and various solar cycles. And the temperature bounced up by probably as much as 7 degrees in maybe 50 or 100 years. So it was really extreme. This chaotic melting happened. And we bounced from a completely frigid world into this beautiful place that we have now, you know, temperate. Within 1,000 years, Britain was green and forested. It was the most remarkable transformation. The snag now is that we are pumping so much CO2 into the atmosphere that we're now in another episode of global warming, but we're not starting from an ice age. We're starting from this beautiful, temperate, warm island that we're in already. And so when the scientists talk about a warming of between 2 degrees and 5 degrees, 2 degrees is pretty extreme. 5 degrees is unbearable. Mm. And will trigger massive migrations issues of famine around the entire planet. So the current aim should really be 1.5 degrees by the end of the century, but that's going to be really, really tough. And that's going to mean massive adaptation. So we both need to mitigate to reduce the CO2, and we need to adapt very quickly to these changing circumstances. And that's not just rising sea level, it's changing crops, it's changing vegetation, bird migration patterns are going to change. We've already seen, for example, fish stocks changing in the northern hemisphere because the seas are warming. So everything's going to change as the temperatures go up. So it is happening, we've got to adapt to it. But we also need to take the precautionary measures that will keep a lid on it at maybe 1.5, max 2.
Mm. And some countries are adapting in terms of buying land in other parts of the world, aren't they?
That's right. Fiji has become a refuge for islanders in the Pacific whose lands are becoming inundated. So they have bought land on Fiji, but Fiji itself, the lower parts of Fiji, are also going to become inundated. And, of course, there are parts of the world. Bangladesh is a classic example. I cycled through Bangladesh way back in the 80s, and it is astonishing how low-lying the southern part of the Ganges Delta is. As you pedal along, you're on these raised dirt roads and paths that are maybe only a metre above sea level. And the water's running, you know, hundreds of kilometres inland through this fingery delta. So you imagine, you know, we're looking at between 20 centimetres and a metre sea level rise by the end of the century. You're looking at that water inundating enough land to displace millions and millions of Bangladeshis alone. So where are they going to go? They're all going to move to higher ground. And we'll see that happening in Europe as well. There'll be huge migrations.
Mm. You've just come back from Antarctica, which is often a place that captures the headlines in terms of climate change. What did you find there?
I have kind of very mixed feelings. I tried to give up. Well, I more or less did give up recreational flying about 15 or 20 years ago, and I did keep flying for work because I was presenting BBC documentaries and so on. And I was, until get to Antarctica, you've got to take a plane to South America, so there was a fair bit of anguish involved in that. But I was a speaker on a ship, so I sort of excused myself, and also it isn't really an excuse, but I selfishly, I really, really, really wanted to see Antarctica with my own eyes so that I could write about it. And it was a life-changing experience. It was, despite the fact that I'd read all the books, I'd been thinking about it for 30, 40 years, I was completely unprepared for the sensation of looking at an understanding on the seventh continent, this quiet continent, and knowing that it was far too extreme in terms of its climate for anybody to live, other than in artificial camps, effectively, research stations. It's a huge, huge continent. Just to stand, you know, on a beach looking at so many glaciers that some of them don't even have names, knowing that it's utterly uninhabitable for human beings. It was the closest I realised. You know, lots of things I realised. One of the things I realised was that this is as close as you can come on the planet without leaving the planet. So it's like, you know, I'm never going to go into space, but this is almost like going into space. You're standing somewhere that is utterly alien and uninhabitable, while also being stunningly beautiful. And the thing that, and we've all watched David Attenborough's amazing documentaries, and we know because we've seen the telly about the wildlife, but when you're surrounded by, orca whales, humpback whales, penguins by the millions, sea lions, just any number of just wildlife coming in all directions. It just makes you realise how rich and diverse the less troubled parts of the planet are. And our own North Sea was like that once. You know, 10,000 years ago, at the beginning of the Mesolithic, the North Sea was like that. It was just teeming with wildlife. Mm. It was a real eye-opener. Mm. So I'm really writing about it now. It was a life-changing experience, definitely.
So physically unique, but also in terms of actually human geography, Antarctica is interesting from a sort of a treaties point of view, and how actually lots of different nations and organisations kind of make it work.
Yes, it's been. If you look at the Times Comprehensive Atlas of the World, you'll see that Antarctica has been divided up rather like slices of a cake by countries who have laid claim to segments. But it's not owned by anybody.
No.
It's an unowned continent, and it should definitely stay that way. I think it's incredibly important that Antarctica remains as pristine as possible, an unowned territory, as a neutral global territory of the commons.
Do you think that there's a model there for other parts of the world?
Certainly for the oceans, yeah. I mean, the oceans, and technically the oceans are the same, except that unfortunately the wildlife in the oceans tends to migrate into fishery zones where they get fished out, and therefore the commons pool gets denuded. But yeah, I mean, the great area of conservation now, the big issue for us all is the oceans and preserving marine habitats. Mm. Yeah.
We touched on physical geography and human geography, and I have to say, when probably we both did O level, that was what there was. There was one or the two. But actually, now geography's spread out, hasn't it, in terms of psychological geography, cultural geography, and so on. Tell us, what's cultural geography?
Cultural geography, well, you'll get involved in cultural geography, particularly if you enjoy the geography of towns and cities. In the old days, you would find these diagrams, when I was a student, diagrams of cities divided up into the central business district and then the residential zones and then the industrial areas and the suburbs and so on. So it's all very clean cut. But now you have cultural zones which could be linear and they could cross-cut across other zones, mixed areas of ethnicity, for example, would be one area of cultural activities. Or ethnicity is also quite interesting in the sense that if you look at the breakdown of, this is something I researched quite a bit in my book, citizen geography is on the rise, this idea that we can all be practicing geographers. And in there's an area of a kind of a lesser developed area within Nairobi that has now been mapped by Nairobi's citizen geographers. Now, these zones used to be called slums. We don't call them slums anymore. It's a rather derogatory term, and they need to be looked at more as less economically advantaged areas. But in many of these areas, they have, and Nairobi is a classic example, these are areas of great innovation and entrepreneurship. So if you walk into some of the lesser developed zones in any part of the world, you'll find, for example, people mending mobile phones. Well, you know, if you bust a mobile phone in London, you can have real trouble getting it fixed. If you walk into a lesser developed area in Africa, you're going to find a mobile phone mender who's got the tools and got the know-how to mend your phone. Mm. So there's a lot of or cobblers. You know, try and find a cobbler in London now, really difficult. But you'll find people who know how to mend shoes. So these culturally geographic kind of distinct areas need to be looked at in a renewed light. One of the great projects the RGS is involved in at the moment is called Migrants on the Margins. It's looking at the mechanisms behind the reasons that people move from the countryside to medium-sized cities in Africa and Asia. And actually, we don't know enough about those mechanisms, because that's the first stage in the process that actually ultimately forces people to end up in camps along the English Channel, taking incredibly hazardous journeys to get to Britain. So we need to understand why people give up everything in their home village and move to town, and the RGS is involved in a research project doing that right now.
Mm. The citizen geographer idea is interesting because it then means that the people who live there are deciding how to identify that area rather than somebody from outside coming in.
Yeah.
People may know there's a Jamaican actually poet and novelist called Kai Miller who has a poetry collection called The Cartographer Tries to Map the Road to Zion or something like this. It is beautiful. And it's about that tension between, well, actually, you know what, the indigenous people are here and they see different things to this person who's coming from a colonial background and saying, well, actually, no, there's a mountain there and these are the Quantar lines and whatever, but no, it's actually so-and-so lives down there. So I guess cultural geography is coming to the fore, but it's not necessarily a new thing. We just perhaps see it
you're right, it's a very old thing, and in fact it's innate in all human beings. There's been some really interesting research done actually by a team of American and British geographers and psychologists who found that we all develop the ability from the age of about four to make what they described as map-like models. So from very, very early, before we can write, we know how to use our toys to create maps on the ground. So we use blocks of wood, or we might use bits of furniture or toy cars or Lego, and we make these kind of miniaturized versions of reality on the carpet or the floor. So we're making kind of juvenile maps before we even know what a map is. So our mind, we're hardwired to think in terms of maps. So my argument is that if we're making map-like models at the age of three or four, then basically we're already geographers. We're already relating to spaces. I mean, all of us here today have mapped this space here. Actually, I'm so useless with internal space, I will definitely get lost trying to find the way out. But most of you will know where the loos are, where the nearest coffee place is, and where the stands are. You've already visited. So you've already made a kind of mental map of this space. And certainly when you get outside, you'll know the way to tube station. With a bit of luck, I can find my bicycle. I can more or less remember where I locked it up. So, we've already created mental maps. We're doing it all the time, making mental maps. I think a worry, actually, are these navigational aids on telephones, on our mobile phones. And, we all use them, I use them as well, but actually they're not maps. People call them Google Maps. They're not maps at all, they're navigational aids. And we really should be very careful not to erode the hard wiring that allows us to do mental mapping, because that's the basis of your citizen geography. Mm. And children learn citizen geography in the primary school when they'll go out and start doing field work. I know in year six at most primary schools you'll now go out, either with a real map or you'll just go out into local park and start making drawing maps of where the trees and the paths are and so on to learn how things fit together. So citizen geography is something that we're both hardwired to do, and also primary in Britain teaches you about.
Talked recently about actually not the demise of maps actually through the digital side, but actually how it's reinvigorated the paper map that we all might buy at Stanford's and take out on a Sunday afternoon walk or indeed a 10,000-kilometre trip across Europe.
Yeah, I was very lucky. A couple of weeks ago, the Financial Times got in touch and asked if I'd write a newspaper article for the paper about Stanford's and their big move from Longacre around the corner. And it gave me the chance to dig into the Stanford's archive, now owned by the Royal Geographical Society, and I found all sorts of amazing Stanford's maps that had been published. It was a real eye-opener. And part of my research involved talking to Vivian Godfrey, who, the boss of Stanford's. And it's very interesting looking at the sales figures, both the Ordnance Survey maps and also Stanford's maps, to see that paper maps are now holding their own. They're not going to disappear. For a while, 10 years ago, we all thought that e-books were going to destroy printed books. That hasn't happened. E-books are now levelled out. Sales are not going up, but printed books are going up. They're very healthy, and paper maps will continue to be used because when you think about it, you know, how much can you really see on the, you know, small screen on a phone? Not very much. If you really want to see where Olympia fits into London, you've got to open up a big A to Z. When I was, I just thought, I wonder if I got an interesting route to cycle down here. And I could have looked at the phone, but actually, I'd got out the old A to Z paperback.
You couldn't possibly have done that today.
Well, I'm always looking for new routes. And and I remember filming, before I filmed Coast, I filmed, made a series to BBC called Matman. And we spent a day at RAF Lossiemouth with the Tornado bomber crews. And I was with the navigator, the chap who has to tell a pilot where to fly. And we went in the briefing room, and I was completely amazed, because outside you've got these incredible aircraft, state-of-the-art, fly-by-wire, you know, all the electronics and stuff. You go in the navigator's den, and it's full of oak map chests, you know, sort of things you saw in Stanford 50 years ago. And they pull open the big drawers, and they get out paper maps. And I said, you know, are you serious? Are you really using paper maps to fly these aeroplanes? He said, yeah. No, we do all of our planning on paper maps, because you need a big paper map to understand the context of where you're going to fly the aeroplane. So if you're flying, and in this case, you're flying an aeroplane at 600 miles an hour through mountains, so you need to see all the mountains in one viewpoint. So we plan, we do the flight path on the paper map, then we download the coordinates onto this thing called a rubber brick, which is all, it's like a big hard drive. You take that out of the aeroplane, you leave the paper map behind, but you do the planning on the paper map.
Mm. How different is it doing telly to books, and which do you prefer?
How different is it doing telly
to
books?
I'm just thinking about the solitude versus the crew and the team.
Well, I mean, that's the difference. You know, writing books, you are sitting on your own, drinking far too much coffee, and trying not to go down to the kitchen for the 100th time that hour. And when you're filming, you're in a group of 6 or 8 people, desperate to get a coffee, and you're never going to get one because you're all too busy, you know, moving from one place to next. And it's very frantic. I guess the main difference, selfishly, as someone who likes words, is that writing a book is very willful. You can you don't have to ask anybody permission to write. You just do what you want. It's incredibly liberating. If you're writing for TV, then the script has to be understandably passed by the director, by the executives back in London or Glasgow, wherever you're working from. And it's a collaborative team effort. And so it can end up, you know, you can end up being a bit of a committee job if you're not careful. But the team is critical. If you've got a good team, you can do great, great TV.
Yeah, with not too many egos, I can imagine.
Yeah, there is that. Yeah, I mean, luckily, you know, contrary to expectations, I mean, the worst egos are invariably the presenters.
Present company accepted.
So, I'm probably the wrong person to ask about that.
There's a chapter in the book called How I Found My Inner Geographer.
Right, yeah.
How did you?
I alluded to it actually earlier on. Back in the 90s, I walked across Europe from following the mountain watershed from one side of the continent to the other. And I was alone. This was before the age of mobile phones. I had no GPS, so I was using paper maps. I had no tent for the first few months, so I had a very small pack. I was sleeping under the stars. I had no cooking equipment, so I'd have to light open fires. I didn't have a sauce, but I just had a stainless steel mug. I'd put that on the fire. I had no torch. I had no waterproofs. I was very lightly loaded.
Was that bad planning or deliberate?
No, it was deliberate. But I just took a punt on it. I was wearing a jacket made of stuff called Ventile, which is it's cotton, but it's water repellent. But it, once it's wet, it stays wet for 2 or 3 days. No, it was all about lightweight and mobility. I wanted to travel as lightly loaded as possible, so that with a very small pack, so I'd feel unencumbered, as if I wasn't carrying anything at all. And actually, there is safety in mobility. If you're not heavily loaded, you can cover probably 30, 40, 50% greater distances per day if you have to. So if you're in an emergency, say an unexpected storm catches you out on a high plateau, and that does happen, And if you're lightly loaded, you can evacuate, get out of the mountains very quickly. If you're staggering around with, you know, the kitchen sink on your back, you know, that in itself can be dangerous. So I relied on mobility, and to answer your question, it was back to Mesolithic. The age of hunting and gathering. Because I had no torch, I relied on starlight and moonlight, and it took me several phases of the moon, several months, to drop back into this state of being, if you like, where I felt I had a harmony, really, with the great outdoors. I felt completely at home in 2,000-metre mountains in the middle of the night, in huge, deep, black forests, crossing remote plateau. I felt very relaxed and confident and easy with my surroundings, and much less confident and easy with my surroundings when I came into a town or village now and again. And I found that I became very lunar, very moon-related, so that as the moon grew in size, I would get more and more energetic, until on the night of a full moon, I would be in a state of kind of manic activity where there's no possibility of sleeping.
That's like your werewolf.
It was a bit werewolf. And in fact, one night, I remember in the mountains of Lozère, where Robert Louis Stevenson walked with his donkey, Modestine. I'd been following his route for a few days, and it was snowing, and one night, under a full moon, I climbed the top of a fir tree at midnight, and I was shrieking at the moon.
Now, there's an image.
Which is kind of quite hard to explain here at, you know, sea level in London, in Olympia, but actually seemed quite normal at the time.
What was your aim when you set off on that journey? I mean, did you want to convene with nature, or I mean, did you have a book in mind that you were going to write, or was it just about getting away and finding yourself? Do you remember?
It wasn't anything very complicated. I didn't have a book to write. I assumed I probably would do, but I had no book commission. I just went. It was very much, I'd always been very moved by the opening pages of Laurie Lee's As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning, and I'd always been very moved by the opening pages of Patrick Leigh Fermor's A Time of Gifts. Mm. You know, both those books begin with a young man in this case, but it could have been a woman, just kind of thinking, yeah, I'm off. Backpack, I'm out of here. And I just wanted to know what that was like. It was just curiosity. It's very simple, just curiosity. And then everything else followed.
Which is perfect for a geographer, isn't it?
Yeah.
You better have some curiosity. Yeah. So you've just finished being president of the Royal Geographical Society for the last 3 years. What are you most proud of achieving there?
I think without doubt helping to find a successor to Dr. Rita Gardner. The director had been there for 22 years. And it fell during my 3-year watch to help find her successor. And we found Professor Joe Smith from the Open University, who's now in place as the new director. And it's a very exciting time. It was an interesting thing, because actually, for any of you who come to the Royal Geographical Society, you know, the public side of the RGS is the Monday night lectures. I'll be down there tomorrow night. Which are, we've got an auditorium that holds 700 people, and there's an amazing lecture tomorrow night. It's William Atkins talking about deserts.
And if you're a member of the RGS, you come along for free, don't you, on Monday evening?
Yeah, if you're a fellow, you come for free, absolutely. And but actually, the finding Rita's successor was very much behind the scenes. It was to do with committees and collaboration with various groups of people and so on, in consultation with fellows. It was an enormously time-consuming but very valuable thing to have done. So that was my big moment, yeah.
Mm. I mean, it's such an august and, you know, historical and, you know, important organisation. How does that... What plans do they have, really, to continue to stay relevant?
Very simple answer, and it goes back to where we started our chat. The RGS has a very, very active education programme, both within schools, with Steve Brace, and universities with Catherine Souch, two of the senior managers. And And also actually through the collections, because they're open to the public. The Boyle Reading Room is open to the public. And that's Alistair MacLeod who runs that. So the RGS is absolutely at the forefront of sharing geographical knowledge and promoting teachings at school and university through many different ways. So there are events for school teachers, there are events for university lecturers, there are events for students both at school and at university at the RGS. So the RGS, to my mind, of all of the organisations in the UK, there's not one charity that I'd rather be devoting so much of my free time to than the RGS, because I do think they, in Britain, they do hold the future in their hands.
Yeah. Let's get the microphone out if we may, Roddy. Stick your hand up if you've got a question. We'll come to you over here first. Good running, thank you.
First of all, thank you very much, Dade, for your brilliant question and answer session. But what particular journey for any of your writings did you enjoy the most?
What particular journey have I enjoyed the most? Do you know, it's always the last one. So for me, just coming back from Antarctica, that was, well, we've already talked about that, but I won't go there again, but I'll just mention the I've talked about walking across Europe. That was probably the one that had the greatest effect on me, because I was on my own for a year and a half, sleeping up in the mountains, meeting local people, particularly shepherds, because the people you meet most frequently in the mountains are going to be shepherds in the spring, summer and autumn. I ended up snowshoeing the length of the Alps in winter, so I didn't meet many people during those 3 or 4 months. I spent an awful lot of time trying not to freeze to death. It's much more, you know, dealing with avalanches and low temperatures. So that was a survival exercise more than anything, over the top of Mont Blanc and so on. But the year or so, the year and a quarter that wasn't winter, that was, you know, I was meeting a lot of people and those are it's the encounters that you remember. It's walking into a Bulgarian village, roasted, you know, clothing full of holes and rips, you know, everything's worn out, very ragged. And as well, I remember walking through one Bulgarian village. I'd come out of the Pirin Mountains. I'd only got another 3 or 4 weeks of walking to go to get to Istanbul. And I was covered in dust. And I was really very ragged, and I was also quite footsore because in the heat my feet were blistering up. And I went through this village, and by the time I got to the far side of the village, so many people had leant over their garden walls, giving me handfuls of tomatoes and grapes, that I couldn't carry anymore. I mean, I was staggering under the weight of free fruit. And those are the things you remember. Or the people who, a shepherd in the mountains of northern Spain, who hadn't seen anybody for weeks, you know, who wasn't another shepherd, and the weather was appalling. There was a big storm blowing. He had a small stone shelter. It was only about 6 foot in diameter. He had a little wooden cot at one side of it. But he said, "No, come inside, sleep in here." And so I lay on the mud on the other side of the fire, spent the night with him, and. And he divided his supper into two. You can imagine, if you're living in the mountains as a shepherd for 4 months, you're not eating that much. You know, you've got a few tatties and some rice and a bit of goat meat, whatever, a bit of cheese, and that's about it. So he split his supper into two, and luckily I'd carried, as you do in these mad trips, I'd got a whole jar about that big of olives that I'd bought in a mountain village just as a treat for myself. So I was able to leave him this jar of olives. Of course, for him, that was a real luxury. And that was a very special moment, because the happiness he brought me through the company, through not sleeping outside in a storm without a tent, because, you know, if you sleep outside in a bivy bag, that bivy bag is going to be full of water in the morning, however good it is. And through having that hot food with him, you know, he brought me great pleasure. I was able to leave him with a smile on his face with this jar of olives. That was very special. Very special moment.
I bet he still speaks very highly of you as well. Other questions? Who's got a question for Nick? Yeah.
Firstly, thank you for your endorsement of geography. I'm a head of geography at a secondary school, so I totally agree with your endorsement of where we should be on a huge pedestal, and I'll remind my headmaster of that tomorrow morning. And also I'm a fellow of the RGS, and so thank you for your presidency and all your hard work on our behalf. You began talking about how crucial geography is, and of course that's what I talk about every day, but sometimes I find my young students aren't really listening to me. So what advice would you give of how I can engage them with exactly the centrality of geography and the importance of the massive issues they are going to face and that our generation hasn't solved? Just to give me a new idea for tomorrow morning would be lovely.
If I knew the answer to that, I would have been a geography teacher rather than a rather sad writer. My experience, geography teachers know much better than journalists and book writers how to engage their students. I think it's... I was very lucky. I went to a state secondary school, and my geography teacher, Mr. Noble, I went back to see him last year, actually. He's in his 80s now, to tell him how much it meant to me, because he got me going. And I can remember to this day, and this isn't really the answer to your question, but I can remember to this day, this is back in the days of blackboards and rubbers and all that sort of stuff, blackboard rubbers, he drew the different shape of sand dunes that can be created by wind. Yardang, Zeugen, I remember, crescentic sand dunes. And there I was in Norfolk. I'd seen sand dunes on the coast of Norfolk, and so I kind of knew what a sand dune was, but I'd obviously never been to Sahara Desert or proper desert. And that day, he really kind of fired me up about wanting to go to a desert, just by showing what wind can do to different, in terms of blowing. So I think it's a bit random, actually. I suspect in any one classroom of, well, in nowadays it's 30 pupils, isn't it, in maximum class size. Hopefully you're not up at 30, but up to 30 school students, there might be 30 different messages to get each of them fired up. I wish I knew the answer. I mean, you'll know more than I, but it's about, in my case, it was about, I was useless. I failed most of my O-levels, but not geography, and it's because Mr. Noble knew how to get me excited about geography, and I think his own passion came across. That's really what it was, his own passion. It was infectious. I just picked up on it and thought, yeah, I want to go and see a real sand dune. And there is a connection, of course, between being keen on geography and travel, so I think field work is completely crucial. And my son will always tell me that one field trip in his entire school career to Cromer in North Norfolk wasn't quite enough to set him on fire about geography. He ended up doing psychology, but my daughter ended up going to New York for a field trip at another state school, and she's doing human geography at UEA now. So I think the quality of field trip, field work, does, it does have an effect.
Any other questions? I have one. For the adults in the audience, where should we go for a geography-style field trip?
Every holiday is a field trip, isn't it? Every holiday can be turned into a geography trip just by looking around you and chatting to locals. Walking into a local bar and just talking to local people about, what their issues are, what's going on around here, what are the big issues, what are the stories, what's going on with the council, the local village council, who's running the village, what controversies can you share with me? That's the way to have a field trip on holiday.
And far more exciting, actually, than counting how many clover leaves are within that metre square.
The
size of pebbles on the beach, perhaps.
Yeah, beach transects don't seem to work very well, do they, in terms of firing people up? I mean, I ended up doing human geography, but on the other hand, I do love going to mountains, and it was physical geography that got me excited about mountains, because whether you're in Britain or the Alps or the Pyrenees or the Himalayas, we go to the Lake District, full of glaciated landforms, so you can't get the most out of the Lake District unless you know a little bit about glaciation, and that's all GCSE geography.
That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for coming. Nick, thank you for such an inspirational talk. And
thank
also
you,
for all your inspiration on the telly, at the RGS and everywhere else.
Thank you,
tell your year 8s tomorrow morning. Thank you, Nick Crane.